Welcome back, everyone. Thanks as always for joining Craig and myself. Here we are with episode 116, and we are recording this on the 5th of March, 2024. Craig, how are you? You well?
I'm good. Yeah, I finally hit the 6K mark where I tore my calf muscle, so I'm rolling along, no problems at the
Lovely.
moment. So
And let me ask you, since last week's episode where we talked about running on your own versus running in a group and your distraction levels and where you look,
yeah.
certainly when I run solo and I've been overthinking where I've been looking. Have you been doing the same?
Yeah, I have been overthinking where I'm looking, but unfortunately a lot of my late runs lately are so early in the morning it's still dark.
Well, it's probably sensible to be thinking about where you're looking then. Yep. Great. So, welcome wherever you're joining us from. It's funny, I was on my run this evening, and I don't know about you, Craig, but I've got several podcasts, five or six, that I subscribe to and I listen to on a weekly basis, every single week. And my hope is that there are people, and I know there are some people, but my hope was always that people would treat this podcast in the same way. But I find that certain podcasts, depending on the day of the week they're released, some of them I'm always listening to on my commute, some of them I'm always listening to on my run. And I sort of associate certain podcasts with certain things in my life, and I it fascinates me to think that maybe there are some people that are doing the same with our podcast. So if anyone wants to get in touch and tell us how you're consuming us, that's just useful information to us. On which note, we always solicit messages and ask people to get in touch, and we've had quite a few people get in touch since last week, so I just want to run through some of the messages if that's okay. Firstly, several people messaged me. I'm renowned for my horrible pronunciation. Early on, I even said pronunciation incorrectly, if people remember a few episodes back. And a few people mentioned that last week when Craig was talking about Donald Trump's shoes and his red soles, that it sounded like he was saying Louis Vuitton and not Louboutin. And I don't even know if I'm saying those two names correctly. And they just wanted to flag it because they didn't want us getting sued by Louis Vuitton. Not that I'm convinced we're anywhere near their radar, but we
We'll
always welcome. Go on, Craig.
just write that off. We'll just write that off to my accent.
Well, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. If in doubt, blame the accent. We always want to be called out on things we say if you disagree with them factually, or if we've worded them incorrectly, or our pronunciation is poor. So please don't feel bad about doing that. We welcome that. On a similar note, John Osborne, who is I'm sure you know Craig, he's Melbourne based. He's a lovely guy. Had the pleasure of meeting him last year. Actually, big fan. And he sent me a really nice message where, because I was referring to the comment last week about the drug naivety, which was a term I wasn't familiar with, and also drug everuse. And I made reference that I thought maybe it was a typo and maybe they meant overuse. And he sort of pointed out to me that perhaps ever use may refer to ever having used it. I can't rule that out as a really valid possibility as well. And I've had a few people message me as well saying that drug naivety is apparently a very common term used in drug trials and drug trial reports, which I don't particularly spend much time reading. So every day a school day, as they say, for us, very much so as well. Two more messages. One from Dr. Lonnie Noddleman, DPM. Hope I've said your name correct, Lonnie. And just a lovely message, really, that he said he's just discovered the podcast. He thanks us for it because he's really enjoying the episodes and he's listening in Washington, D.C., which is awesome. So it's great that we've got some listeners in America. So hi, Lonnie. Thanks for your message. Really appreciate it. And lastly, Sam Turner, who's in Oz, who many of you may know, who has a penchant for football boots. Do you know Sam, Craig? Have you met Sam before?
I better, yep.
Yeah, I met him as well last year. Lovely, again, lovely guy. As most Aussie podiatrists I've met seem to be, funnily enough. And he asked whether we could, at some point in the future, talk about sesamoid issues, why they're getting missed or poorly managed in elite and sub-elite settings. So, Sam, I promise you, we've added that onto. We've got a little list of things to talk about in future, and to link papers with that, as we see them. So you are on our list, I promise. Right. Craig, before we talk about some articles that have been published in the last week, I saw on your Facebook, I think it was a couple of days ago, that a new shoe is announced. You're known for keeping a database of all of the number of shoes that are currently on the market. So, wow us with the latest.
Well, we're now up to 244 running shoe brands. some of which are defunct. Most of them are what I call one percenters, and that they have less than 1% of the market, but 1% of a big market is still a lot. But this new shoe is actually an old shoe. This is number 244 on my list, and I presume it's pronounced Asaga. It's actually a running shoe from the late 70s. What was called the KT26 was a very popular shoe in the late 70s, early 80s. I do vaguely recall them. I never did actually run in a pair at the time, but they're back. They're back as a retro. So they are available. And anyone interested in the history of running shoes, I'll put a link in the notes. You can go and have a look at what we used to run in the late 70s and the early 80s.
I visualize a shoe from the 70s to 80s as much more, racing flat like in style than perhaps the big cushioned P-backs beasts that we have now. Is that the version they've released? Are they suspecting that will do well in today's market?
I'm not so sure because of the materials used. But having said at this, they came out at the same time as the Nike Waffle Trainer, with that which was. You used to get quite severe scratches on your calf muscles. They were so wide. I don't know whether you've ever seen pictures of them, but I used to, and they used to graze your calf muscle because they were so wide in the heel. So that's your typical shoe from that era. And even if you look at the upper of these shoes, they very, very similar to the Nike Waffle Trainer of the time. Same sort of materials and design.
Great. Well, we'll link to a picture for people who are interested. I know that not everyone loves our shoe facts, but we've certainly got a few people that do. So all the time people want them, we'll keep them coming. So on with the articles in the last 7 days there's been many more than the ones that we've handpicked here, but these are the ones that caught our eye, that we found interesting or worthy of discussion. First up, from a group of researchers in Turkey and published in the Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapies, and it was published last week, 28th of Feb, 2024. It is entitled Pelvic Floor Muscle Strength and Dysfunctions in Women with Pes Planus, a Case Control Study. So ultimately, this study was looking or aiming to compare sort of pelvic floor muscle strength and I guess pelvic floor dysfunctions in women with different foot postures, with and without pes planus, as it referred to. So it recruited, it had two groups of women, 30 in each group. We had the pes planus group, and then we had the control group who did not have pes planus. Now, the way they defined pes planus was by the Feiss line. Just in case there's undergrads or students or new grads not too familiar with the Feiss line, because I'm not sure how much it's taught or it's used currently. The Feiss line is where you mark up the first metatarsal head, the medial malleolus, and the navicular. You draw a completely straight line in between the first metatarsal head and the medial malleolus, and then you look at what you assess the position of the navicular tuberosity relative to this line. And I think in this study, they made reference to how far below that Feiss line it was. So if it was a third of the distance below the line, they called it a grade one. If it was two thirds of the distance below the line, they called it a grade two. And I assume in the control group, it was people whose navicular tuberosity was on the Feiss line, because traditionally that's what's been referred to as an open quotations, normal close quotations foot. They did a few sort of pelvic floor muscle strength and pelvic floor distress inventory sort of scales that I have absolutely no familiarity with whatsoever. But let's cut to the chase and talk about their conclusions, because I think they're the things that we want to try and sort of dig around a little bit. Ultimately, they found that the prevalence of pelvic floor dysfunction and its severity was higher in women with pes planus than it was in the control group. And when we're talking about pelvic floor dysfunction, they were primarily talking about incontinence, so urinary and anal. I think in 116 episodes, that might be the first time I've ever said the word anal on this podcast, and possibly the first and the last. They therefore went on to recommend a foot posture assessment in all individuals that have pelvic floor dysfunction. Craig, please go.
Does this mean we can now use orthotics for pelvic floor dysfunction?
Well, let's not joke that some people will interpret this in that way. Clearly, this was showing some sort of relationship between foot posture and pelvic floor dysfunction. What it didn't do is take the individuals with pelvic floor dysfunction, you know, intervene and see if anything changed. But let's not pretend people won't. You know, you joke, but we know people may well use this in that way.
Oh, of course they will. And I've been around long enough to see it happen so many times that studies like this have been used as evidence that we, yeah, anyway, let's not go that way. No, look, I thought it was interesting because that's not the first study that have looked at similar things. There's been a multitude of studies that have looked at heel height and of the shoe and pelvic floor dysfunction and urinary incontinence in females. The higher the heel, EMG studies have shown the higher the heel, the less forceful pelvic muscle contractions are. So there's no doubt foot posture does affect pelvic muscle dysfunctions. There's even one, and I just read it just before we started today, just a really for a case study. It was actually quite interesting. It was a female runner with urinary incontinence who had all the standard treatments, but whenever she coughed when she was on a run, she had a problem. And then they literally did 2 weeks of gait retraining to reduce impacts and got her into a more minimalist lower heel shoe. And within 2 weeks, it would fix the problem. So, again, only a case study. So, I think we have no doubt that there are issues with shoe heel height. And obviously, now from studies like this one with foot posture and urinary incontinence issue and pelvic dysfunction issues that certainly need further investigation. You know, the next step will be is, well, if it is an issue, do we need to look at more into interventions and proper trials before we start shooting off that we need to use orthotics for people with these sorts of problems?
Yes, as always, you need to temper our conclusions there.
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, on to the second paper. This is a systematic review and meta-analysis, which of course on paper always excites us because it's level one evidence. This was published by a group of researchers in Iran. I think we've talked about certain countries that have high percentages of retractions before, but that's not to say I'm suggesting this need to be retracted. But this was published 4 days ago, so it was on the 1st of March 2024 in PLOS One, and it is called Gait Retraining Targeting Foot Pronation. So they did a systematic review where they took all the studies they could find that they deemed of a high enough quality that had looked at modifying foot pronation sort of metrics or variables with gait retraining. Total of 15 studies they found, which amassed to about 295 people. If we go straight to their conclusions, and then we'll almost start there and then come back and look at the methodology. They said the results of the meta-analysis showed that changing step width does not have a significant effect on peak rear foot eversion. So that's a not effect. They then went on to say results of single studies indicated that reducing foot progression angle and lateralizing the center of pressure can effectively reduce foot pronation. And then they concluded that overall, this study suggests that gait retraining may be a promising intervention for reducing foot pronation. So I had a couple of thoughts before I get your thoughts, Craig. The first is that when we look at, the first is that when you look at the conclusions, it's all quite, it's not really particularly big or singing or dancing with regard to its conclusions, other than this foot progression angle and this lateralizing of the center of pressure. When I looked at it, there were two studies that had looked at reducing foot progression angle. And then and essentially they said two studies showed the foot is more supinated when toeing in, which kind of makes sense. And then there were two studies that looked at lateralizing center of pressure, but they didn't really talk about how they really did that. So the reality is here that and I sent this to my very good friend and colleague, Brad Neal, Dr. Brad Neal. He's just incredible at systematic reviews, meta-analysis, so much superior to me. And I sent him it. I said, "Could you tell me what you think of this?" And he replied, this was a WhatsApp, and he WhatsApped back. He said, "What do you want to know?" I was like, "Well, I read it, and it just doesn't feel right to me. I can't help but think this is a poor bit of work." And his response to me after he skimmed it was, "The interventions are so heterogeneous, and there's next to no data pooling." And I actually then replied saying, can you put that in English for me? Because he's too smart for me. And I don't know what these things mean. But I think what he meant by next to no data pooling is, you know, the reality is they got 15 studies, but they didn't really bring them all together for every single variable. And you look at all the variables they looked at, step width, step length. I think they looked at speed as well, didn't they? They were looking at the studies almost individually. It didn't really feel like a proper systematic review. And final note, all the participants appear to be healthy. So we don't know what happens if we change, retrain sort of pathological people. And I think the other thing is, yes, you can change someone's gait and possibly change their foot pronation, but if you change their foot progression angle or you lateralize their center of pressure, whatever that means, will you just give them a problem somewhere else? I'm constantly reminded by your favorite quote, Craig, which is, you know, you move differently and you load different tissues in different ways. I've horribly paraphrased you there, but what were your thoughts reading this?
Look, I was initially thought, oh wow, this is looks good, but you're right, they didn't really pull the data very well. But if you look at all the studies individually that have looked at some of this, some of those individual studies do actually look quite promising. I have no doubt gait retraining is effective. It's got a huge future. We need to learn a lot more about it. But I still have issues. And obviously the biggest one you alluded to was the healthy subjects. I mean, for argument's sake, the second big issue was also based on the assumption that pronation or overpronation is actually a risk factor for injury.
Quite right.
I don't think, I think in some populations it is, but in others it's not. You know, like so that there's, you know, you're trying to change something. And then the other issue that strikes me with, and this is, I've probably been talking about this for over 20 years. What if someone has, say, like a posterior tibial tendon dysfunction or a tendonitis, and how do you fix their overpronation with gait retraining or muscle strengthening? Well, you're probably going to make the post-tib muscle work harder. I mean, I would have thought the aim is to actually reduce the load in the post-tib muscle, not increase it. So all those issues have not been addressed, and they don't seem to get much mileage. So again, I certainly do use this, do look at it. We do look at what changes can, but we're dealing with a pathological population. We're dealing with a pathology in a tissue that the load in that tissue needs to be reduced, and gait retraining may not do that.
Great. As always, we would love to hear what other people think. There are people out there that we know are very familiar with both writing and also reading systematic reviews and meta-analyses. And like we say, sometimes we see that. We see it's level one evidence and we are sort of immediately sort of excited. But that one feels difficult to be too excited about.
First point about retractions, it's actually in quite a prestigious journal. So it did go through the hoops to get there, which...
Yeah, and we probably should have said, like the first journal we talked about, in you know, the Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapies, quite a low impact factor. I've read some absolute stinkers in there over the years, but plus one, generally you consider that to be quite a high quality journal. Right, last paper. We've got a couple of minutes. It's not particularly relevant to, I guess not relevant to podiatry per se, but Craig saw it. It was published 2 days ago. We thought we'd just give it a quick mention because it's kind of fun. So it's published 3rd of March, 2024. When you hear the title, you won't be surprised to hear it's from a group of researchers from Australia. And it was published in the Journal of Science and Medicine in Sport. And it is called Shots at Goal in Australian Football, Historical Trends, Determinants of Accuracy and Common Strategies. So again, not particularly linked to podiatry, but we have a bit of previous on PodChat Live with AFL. Back in June 2018, our Podchat Live episode number 29, we got all of the AFL podiatrists on. We had an absolute great time with them, great bunch of people. I made a fool of myself because of complete lack of knowledge of AFL. Since then, I've seen an AFL game in Australia, thanks to Artie from Footwork. He looked after me when I was over there and took me to a Hawthorn game. So I'm a Hawthorn fan now. I don't know if that is a good or bad thing. Because like I say, I'm new to this sport, but I do know that I love it. So I'm just going to read out the abstract here. I don't really have enough knowledge to give it any context, so I'll let Craig do that. But ultimately, they looked at 20 seasons of descriptive statistics of shots at goal in AFL. So we're looking at 43,254 shots at goal. And they sort of compared them across 20 seasons over the course of time. Because I think as any sport evolves through time, you expect it to change. You think of, you know, whether you think of rugby or soccer or AFL, you'd assume that, you know, players change and athleticism change and sports science change and tactics change. But the fascinating thing here is that the total number of shots per match and the accuracy of shots have not changed in two decades. Craig, layer on some thoughts and some context for idiots like me that love watching AFL but don't really understand it.
Well, my first thought was that they've got 43,254 data points. You know, my heart goes out to the poor, I presume, PhD student that had to work with that Excel spreadsheet. I don't know what format they got the data in, but they may have had to re-enter them 43,000 times. But the reason this study jumped out at me was I know how much money that, well, I don't know the exact amount, how much the AFL clubs and teams have put into sports science in the last 20 years to try and improve their team's performance. And the accuracy of shots on goal hasn't changed. So what are they spending their money on? That was what sort of jumped out at me was, well, you know, things aren't, you know, they're spending all this money. And interestingly, and I've said this before, that in the AFL, there's a salary cap. So each club is limited to how much they can pay for players' salaries. So, but they weren't limited on how much they could spend on sports science. So some of them are going overboard to try and get the best out of the players that they had. To me, I think this should be a little bit embarrassing that, you know, there's nothing worse than seeing a player in front of goal having a kick and missing. They never live it down. But it's happening, hasn't improved in 20 years. So, So hopefully this is a wake-up call.
Yeah, a great fun paper. Craig, I don't think I've ever asked you who your AFL team is.
Well, I wasn't born in Victoria, so I don't. I'm a rare Victorian without a team.
So you're telling me I've got a team, but you haven't. Is that right? Is that what we're saying here?
I've only been to two games.
Really?
I still watch it most weekends on TV. Yeah.
Perfect. Right. Let's wrap up. So, as always, please do message us if you've got anything to say about anything we've said or otherwise. Our email is getinvolved@podchatlive.com. We're on all the social medias. Our handles are podchatlive. You can share the podcast with friends, with colleagues. I haven't mentioned the ratings, reviews, because we're now comfortably over the 50 that I wanted. We're at 61 on Spotify, which is marvelous. Apple listeners, you're still lagging. So we'd love some reviews and some ratings on Apple if you would be so kind. But yeah, we just appreciate everyone listening, and we would appreciate if you just share us with your colleagues to spread the love. We will be back, as always, next week in 7 days' time, talking more about what we've seen in the meantime. And Craig, as always, it's been a pleasure, and we'll catch up next week.
All right. No worries. We'll see you next week. Thanks.